Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee and the studios of WMOT-FM. Our guest this morning is Dr. Jid Lee, who is a tenured professor of English at MTSU. Her book is called To Kill a Tiger, A Memoir of Korea. It's about her life growing up in South Korea after the end of the Korean War and both the personal and historical aspects of that existence are interwoven quite beautifully and seamlessly throughout the book. Jid's with us right now by telephone from her home. Thanks for being with us today, Jid.
Thank you for inviting me, Gina.
The first part of the book is an anecdote about how one of your ancestors had to do something to allow herself to die, to essentially commit suicide, to be eaten by a tiger in order to save her family. And that anecdote sort of serves as the genesis of the title To Kill a Tiger, because at the end of it you say you would have taken a sword and cut the tiger in half. Talk to us a little bit about what that means for the way women's position was in that society and how it evolved over time.
Well, I grew up in a very orthodox Confucian patriarchal family, and I could give you two different levels about that, one of which is women were raised to be given away to their husbands' families. So before they got married, they were called outsiders by their native families because they were raised to be married off to other families, and they functioned primarily as caretakers for their husbands' families. And their self-sacrifice, Confucian patriarchy believed, was absolutely critical for the prosperity of the family. So women were supposed to sacrifice themselves for their families. And on another level, while I see this as women's self-sacrificial status in Confucian patriarchy, I see it on another level as men's self-sacrificial status in a third world country. For example, like my father, he was sacrificed for something much larger than himself, for his country and his family and for humanity, so to speak. Men of third world countries like my father had to stand up for something much larger than themselves. They were eaten alive by tigers too. And at first, I described the metaphor to talk about women's self-sacrificial status, but I gradually extend this metaphor for a tiger's stomach to include men who were sacrificed for something larger than themselves. So it is about the human condition in which people found themselves being sacrificed for something larger than themselves.
You talk about your father in a different part of the book, and you say that he would have and should have really given his intellect and his passion gone into politics, but it just really wasn't possible under the regime that was in power at the time. Talk a little bit about that.
He could have cooperated with the right-wing dictatorial regime. But he didn't. It was his choice. And I admire him very much for that. Although I was, you know, disappointed with his male chauvinist ideology, I admire him for not giving in to the pressure to cooperate with the right-wing regime. He was offered a position, a key position, for the inner circle in Park Chung-hee's regime, but he turned it down because for him, integrity was more important than an opportunity. Had there been a democratic administration in South Korea, I think he would have done a brilliant job, and I don't think he would have been eaten alive by a tiger. But at first, if you have read the book, you would know that he was a core member of the student protest that stood up to the right-wing dictators, and right-wing dictators continued to rule South Korea, and he just could not bring himself to compromise his political integrity. And because of that, he suffered a lot. He was hounded by the right-wing secret police, and because he was hounded, his family was hounded, and we constantly suffered.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay.
Now, how did your father's feelings and towards the right-wing regime shape your entire family's perception of the West? Because American foreign policy for so long has been to prop up certain dictators in certain developing nations, despite our democratic ideals, and the bottom line prevailing mentality behind that policy has been, well, he may be a tyrant, but he's our tyrant.
That's what JFK said about the South Vietnamese dictator. He said, he's a bastard, but he's our bastard. And I can tell you that I still have a strong ambivalence about the United States politics, about the United States on the whole. On the one hand, when I was growing up in South Korea, I did have an American dream because I thought in America, women have a bit more freedom than they do in South Korea. And I envied the United States for its cultural diversity, for it being a melting pot and all that. And yet, I could not approve of the U.S. government's political choices that they exercised in South Korea. They set up one dictator after another. I was stricken with an ambivalence. On the one hand, I wanted to go to the United States because I was told that it was a country of freedom. On the other hand, in my daily experience, I saw the dictatorial regime that was set up and sanctioned and aided by the United States running amok. And I am hoping I can bridge the gap and somehow reconcile myself with the contradiction in the images of the United States that I grew up with and I still struggle with.
From the way you write about your mother and her discussions with your father about politics, the way she would recite back some of the things that he said about Syngman Rhee, the leader of South Korea, it seems to me as though your mother had the intellect and the passion also to raise herself to a higher level if she had had the opportunity in that particular society.
Her sister and brother were sent to college. She was older, 7 years older than her sister, and at that time, there was a very speedy generational change. Had she been born 7 or 10 years later, I think she would have gone to college, and she would have grown to be a really brilliant scholar. What she didn't have was the language of a scholar. She had the content. She had a sophisticated mind, but she didn't have the language, and she almost picked up the language from my father. So she was brilliant in repeating my father's language, although she herself had the content. And what is frustrating for me when I talk to her is she always repeats the political dialogue that my father gave her. And I'm thinking, Mom, do you have anything else to talk about? She has a lot of other things to talk about. She's brilliant, although she's ignorant, because, you know, that's a human contradiction. She's a village woman, and she says, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. She's obsessed with appearance. But on the other hand, when she talks about political affairs of not only Korea, but also of the whole world, she's just enormously knowledgeable. And I think it's because her husband gave her the political content and the language up to a large degree. And when it comes to talking about the political content her husband gave her, she can even reproduce his language. But she doesn't have her own content and language about other things. Now, no, let me put it this way. Let me backtrack. She can reproduce the content and the language that my father gave her. But when it comes to other things, she has a high level of content. She's very smart, but she doesn't have the language that will carry her to express that content when it comes to non-political things. Does this make sense to you?
Yes, it does. It seems to me that it was partly what inspired you to go into higher education, which is all about helping students develop critical thinking skills. She had the intellect, but not the wherewithal, it seems, or the guidance or the mentoring to develop her critical thinking skills. And I'm wondering if that's sort of what you mean when you write, "I realized that my dreams of achieving were made possible by my nightmares." A nightmare for you, I gather, would be ending up to be, although you loved and admired your parents, to be as subservient as your mother was practically forced to be.
My mother showed me the curse of the gap between a developed brain and the lack of language. She didn't know how to say it because she didn't have higher education. But she was smart and perceptive, so I was driven to bridge that gap. I thought I had to acquire language that she couldn't acquire. Because, you know, there's a cliche, if you don't know how to say it, you don't know how to say it. And I didn't want to get stuck in that trap. I inherited her intellect and willpower, but I did not want to inherit her lack of language. So I worked incredibly hard to acquire that language that would enable me to bridge the gap.
And that's why you are an English professor.
I think so.
There is another thing that I wanted to talk about, and that is the sense of history that you got as South Korean children from the time you were very little. You talk about the mythologies and the demonization of the North Koreans, red horned devils who killed children, raped women, slaughtered the elderly. It sounds a great deal like the Nazis' demonization of the Jews, almost. Talk a little bit about that.
It was a demonization, and if Nazis' demonization of the Jews was committed because of racial hate, South Korea's demonization of North Korea and vice versa was caused because of ideological hate. And I think that sometimes ideological hostility could be just as scary as racial hostility. However, I see hope in it because even when we demonized North Koreans, we still saw them as our brothers and sisters, and there still is this family ethos running deeply in the Korean mind. That's the Korean mind. South Koreans still call suffering North Korean people as our brothers and sisters, and North Koreans still see South Koreans as their brothers and sisters. It is not a racial division, and as ideologically hateful as we are against each other, still, as long as this family ethos that we see each other, family-oriented ethos, as long as that is there, I still see hope. And that ideological hate was perpetuated by the politicians who wanted to stay in power by creating a sense of adversity. South Korean dictator wanted to stay in power by demonizing North Korean dictator, and North Korean dictators wanted to stay in power by demonizing South Korean dictator, because hate brings a base instinct in people and gets them united, although it is a really terrible emotion.
That brings up a point about race, because Asians in diaspora do not see themselves united as one. There are frictions and tensions between the Chinese and the Japanese and, you know, various other groups. Is that also, as you see it, ideologically based?
I have to think about it a little, because I don't want to give you a hasty answer, because all I can give you is a guess of mine. This is a well-educated guess. Mm-hmm. All the other answers I've been able to answer with my experience, I think it comes from Asians' mentality that is deeply rooted in a racial sense of homogeneousness. Asians love to present themselves as being homogeneous. They have a very little concept of the melting pot. The Japanese thrive on them being exclusively Japanese. Chinese thrive on their sense of being Chinese, exclusively Chinese. Koreans do the same thing. I grew up, since I was born, with a strong concept of racial homogeneousness in Korea. Racial homogeneousness means a lot to these Koreans and Japanese and Chinese. And even though we look alike, I think that it may be a little harder for these Asians to come together because of the national ethos that is so deeply rooted in racial homogeneousness. I mean, we grew up believing that Koreans are 100% Korean, that Japanese grew up believing Japanese are 100% Korean. And this sense of racial homogeneousness keeps these Asian countries, each of these Asian countries, exclusive. And of course it does some good. It makes them united, but it makes them exclusive. And that is maybe part of the phenomenon that you see. We see ourselves as Koreans and Japanese and Chinese before we see ourselves as Asians.
Yes, I see. You talk about your ambivalence toward the West when Americans came over to Korea to fight in the war. They were fighting on the side of the South Koreans, but they didn't look like you. They didn't talk like you. What sort of indoctrination did you receive as children in terms of how you were to think about Americans? And does the ambivalence you feel toward the West now, is that indicative of a greater ambivalence across South Korean society?
The ambivalence that I grew up with about the United States comes from two different images that I got about the U.S. First, in schools, we were told that the U.S. was heroes, that the U.S. Army saved us from the brutalities of the communist regime in North Korea. That's what we were told in school. When I went home, however, because of my father's once politically active career and his rejection of the right-wing regime, which tried to coax him into it, we grew up with a strong ambivalence against the United States. We knew what the U.S. Army did in South and North Korea. We knew that the United States Army bombed North Korea into Stone Ages. And we knew that South Korean Army raped North Korean women and vandalized and executed and tortured them. But in school, in the history books, we were told that the South Korean and the U.S. Army was angels with wings. And I tried to bring those two images together. I'm not sure if I'm still successful. Look, I am teaching a book right now about the U.S. The My Lai style massacre. You know, My Lai massacre in Vietnam.
Yes, and there was a similar massacre in Korea, but not much has been written about it.
It's just coming up, and whenever I am reminded of the Americans' historical crimes in Korea, I just get outraged. But still, it's my choice to live in this country. It's my choice to embrace the cultural diversity that the United States is able to offer me. I think you asked me one more question.
Does the ambivalence about the West, is it indicative of a general feeling in South Korean society? Or is this just your own personal viewpoint?
I think that the ambivalence towards the West, a lot of it is from my generation. And I'm not sure if my nephews and nieces have the same ambivalence. They are desperate to learn English. I mean, they make great cell phones. They make good and cheap cars. Everything they do is in imitation of the United States. They are geniuses in imitating the West. But in my generation and in my parents' generation, we grew up with such a strong ambivalence toward the West. Okay, we tried to absorb Western liberalism, the concept of individual dignity and, you know, women's equality. My favorite writer was John S. Mill, and I believe that I am a strong liberal in that sense because I believe in women's personal dignity, and I believe in equality. I believe in the justice and equality for women of color. My work reflects that, and in my daily routines, that is what's driving me. I want to bridge the gap between whites and white male and women of color, and my specialty is multicultural women's literature, women's autobiography, and multicultural literature. I teach women's studies and multicultural literature, and in my classes, consistently, I emphasize the equality of women of color and the white male. We have to bridge the gap. We have to walk away from the concept of American literature that is defined by Hemingway and Faulkner. Although I like Hemingway and Faulkner, the traditional canon of American literature has been predominantly defined by the white male. We leave it at that. We like them. We respect these white male authors. But there is something else that is just as important, and we must equalize this something else to the white male canon. And the ambivalence that I feel toward the West, I think, is directly manifested in my teaching. I love American literature that was formed and defined by the white male, but at the same time, this American literature that I love excluded women of color so mercilessly until the civil rights movement came up.
Nobody ever heard about Zora Neale Hurston until after the civil rights, until after she was dead, practically.
Until after she was dead. Nobody heard about Zora Neale Hurston until Alice Walker dug her up. And so politically, look, here's the thing. I love it, but I find myself in a dilemma. How can I tell my students to challenge what I love and what they love? How can I challenge my students to not to disown their parents, but to see how exclusive and prejudiced their parents were? So I'm always running up against a stronger level of resistance from my students because they do not want to hear it.
Why do you refer to your siblings in the book as Big Brother, Big Sister, and Less Big Brother instead of by their names?
That's the Korean custom. We do not call older siblings by their first names. And I try to reproduce that. I could have called them by their names, but I thought if I call them by their names, okay, let me put it this way.
That would be Western instead of Korean.
That would be Western instead of Korean, and I think that would be a bit phony, Gina, because I still don't call them that way. I think this is one of the fascinating components of the book. It's written in English. It's written for American audiences, but I reproduce the ancient Korean tradition that I grew up with. Well, it's not ancient, excuse me. It's very modern. In Korea, very few people, in fact, I do not know anyone who calls their older siblings by their first name. But I said in my disclaimer, author's note on authenticity, I do that maybe because I want to let it go with the laughter. So look at a book that's written in English, written for Western audiences, and yet I reproduce the Korean custom.
Well, maybe I think that probably goes along to make the authenticity of the book stand out as much as it does. But it's a funny thing talking about the blending of cultures and the rejecting of the shortcomings of one's parents and one's ancestors. It's easy to say in the abstract, isn't it, that I reject this kind of culture or this kind of ideology or I don't like this. But it's more difficult when you realize how interwoven that narrative is with your own life. And you have to look at it as a more complex picture than just, well, I don't like this and I like that.
It is much harder when somebody tells me about how I'm a product of that gap between our sense of justice and reality. And I'll give you an episode about what happened in my 20th century women writers class. I talked about Zora Neale Hurston and Marita Banner. They were both African-American women authors. And Zora Neale Hurston really was forced to play up to her white patrons. She had to get every penny to survive from these rich white people who supported her. And her narrative is full of contradictions. She says in one of her essays, slavery is over. And she wrote this in the 1920s. And then she says something else in her memoir. And then there's another woman named Marita Banner. She doesn't do that. Although I do not know about her as much as I know about Zora Neale Hurston, I told my students, look what she's doing. We love Zora Neale Hurston. We as audiences love Zora Neale Hurston because she's playing up to our expectation of women of color. She's pleasing us. She's saying slavery is over. It is each individual's sense of responsibility now that matters. However, Marita Banner doesn't play up to her white audiences like that. She's much more honest. She doesn't say things like slavery is over in the 1920s. Well, we as audiences, I said this very nicely, should pay more attention to authors like Marita Banner than Zora Neale Hurston. We prefer Zora Neale Hurston because she's more pleasant for us to read. And my students didn't like that. And I could see, although I said that politely, I could see that they didn't like it. Besides, when I taught Maxine Hone Kingston, she wrote Woman Warrior, in her first chapter, she talks about what happened in a village in China. And there's this woman who had an extramarital affair while her husband was going to the United States to make money. She was condemned to death by the whole village. And I said, it's partly because of the U.S. immigration policy. Her husband, who was going to the United States, could not bring his wife to the U.S. because there was a law called the Chinese Exclusion Act. I pointed it out very politely. My students gave me a long, resistant silence because they didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to hear the fact that the U.S. immigration policy was just as problematic as the Chinese village mindset, that they wanted to condemn Chinese sexism, but they wanted to turn a blind eye to the discriminatory immigration policies of their own country. So when we talk about these matters in abstraction, they accept it. But when I actually point at their blind spot, when I have to point at what their own country does and what their own preference is as a member of this country, they do not like me.
It's funny how we have come to associate patriotism with lack of constructive criticism sometimes, and we seem to have forgotten that a provocative telling of truth to power is what this country was founded on in the first place.
Well, we understand that in abstraction, and we accept it when we are not the subject of the topic. When that's human nature, you know, who wants to be told that they have to change their own attitude? Everybody likes to point their finger at someone else. When I tell them that they have to change their mind as audiences, they do not like to hear that. They like to hear that it's someone else's fault. So they like to stay on vague abstraction.
When you think about the ancestor who was eaten by the tiger, what do you think that woman would think of you as you are today, someone who has broken barriers and said that she will not be confined by any particular modality or culture or ideology?
I'll tell you what, though. Okay. I have not been able to get out of my country in my mind. Do you know the cliche? You can get a girl out of a Chinatown, but you cannot get the Chinatown out of a girl. You can get me out of Korea, but you cannot get Korea out of me. Now, that's the thing. I haven't been able to get out of it emotionally. I still call my mother 3 times a week because she panics when I don't call her. But you are right. To some degree, I did get out. On a conscious level, I liberated myself. I broke the mold. I understand that. I think that my great-great-great-great-sixth-grade's grandmother would be proud of me because that's what she would have chosen to do. At that time, 200-300 years ago, the only choice she had was through motherhood. That was her way of making her name. I don't even know her name. But in 2010, I have other ways of making my name. And I didn't choose motherhood, although I think, you know what, sometimes at midnight when I pet my cats, I wonder if children might be better than cats. I don't have regrets about it. Sometimes I'm just curious. You know, there is a fine line between regrets and curiosity. Mm-hmm. It's too late to regret now, but I've chosen another path, and I think that tiger woman would be proud of me, but she would also see that I'm in another tiger's stomach. I have my own tiger's stomach, And I just told you about what happens in my classrooms, and people, most people in this country refuse to see me as an American. They always see me as a Korean woman because my face is different and I have an accent. And I will never get out of the tiger's stomach. I can only jump from one tiger's stomach into another tiger's stomach. And for a while, it looks better. When I finished my PhD in Kansas, when I came to Tennessee, it looked better for a while. Then it gets old and it becomes a tiger's stomach. Now, if I get out of here, I think that place also will become a tiger's stomach for me. And until I'm dead, I'll never get out of the tiger's stomach, and I don't want to get out of it, because only when I'm dead, I will be out of it.
Well, don't go to the Nashville Zoo and jump into the tiger habitat, okay?
Well, that's a thought. Thanks for giving me an idea.
The book is called To Kill a Tiger, A Memoir of Korea, from the Overlook Press. And the author is Dr. Jid Lee of the Department of English. Thank you for being our guest today. It was really delightful.
Thank you very much, Gina.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.